Well, good morning, everyone. Alan is shutting the doors, so that means it's time for me to start talking. I want to welcome you all to the Bible class this morning. I know we have a number of visitors, and we appreciate you all worshiping with us today. We're going to be in Daniel chapter 7, and we've been studying through the book of Daniel the past 7 or 8 weeks or so. And last week, we began what might feel like a challenging transition as you're studying the book of Daniel. As we wrapped up the first 6 chapters, we studied through the life of Daniel, really. We saw him grow from what we think was probably late teenage years into his early or mid-80s, and we watched and read about Daniel being a powerful witness of God to multiple kings of Babylon, and we saw Daniel's capacity for interpreting visions and dreams to those different kings. And then we get to the end of chapter 6, and you start reading chapter 7, and there's just sort of this abrupt change in what you're reading and how it's written and how it's explained. And so last class, we spent the entire time talking about that change. We talked about apocalyptic writings or apocalyptic literature, and we tried to define what that is and why we care what that is. How does that help us in our study of Daniel? And you all were, you know, kind enough to suffer through some of those facts and some of those concepts. I think I could have done a better job tying it together at the end. I think I could have maybe reserved a little more time to put a bow on it and, you know, make it really applicable and easy to use as a tool in the following classes. So I wanted to take 5 minutes and just add one or two more things. We talked about these characteristics of the apocalyptic genre, and I use the word genre in a different way than we're used to using it, right? We typically, when we say genre, we're talking about books or movies or music. We're talking about maybe a form of entertainment, and we try to lump things into their genre. And apocalyptic is a genre of writing that really isn't being written anymore, but was very common and very understood. The people of the first century and the intertestamental period would have been familiar with this genre. And we talked about how somebody in that time frame beginning to read some of these apocalyptic stories would begin to expect certain things to come after it. They would identify it for what it was, and that sort of set their frame of reference in what they were expecting to get out of this writing. And some of the key components of the apocalyptic genre would be, it claims to be from God. There's no question about that when you're reading Daniel, or when you're reading Revelation or parts of Ezekiel. The narrative that comes at you claims to be from God. It is not just a wise person saying, these are things that I've found to be wise. There's a very definite claim that's being made there, that this is God's information to man. And it's a narrative. It's usually a story. And we talked about how that differs from an epistle or from one of the Psalms. It's not written the same way. And so it has to be understood that this is a narrative and that there are lessons that are going to come, or there's a message that's going to come out of that narrative. There's almost always otherworldly beings in play. If you think about some of the passages that you've read in Revelation where there are beasts and there are supernatural creatures, we're going to see some of that this morning in Daniel chapter 7. And lastly, it discloses additional information about our reality that we couldn't get otherwise. This is God's perspective. He has a higher perspective than us. And usually in these writings, he's communicating something to us that we couldn't otherwise know without his perspective. And it puts the events that are taking place on the earth in a higher context, and it helps us understand how God is in control of what's going on the earth. And sometimes his humbling of a king, as we saw in the first few chapters of Daniel, is an expression of his control. It's him reminding us that you can have a worldly kingdom, you can have worldly power, but ultimately I'm in control of that. So here are two, I think, key messages that you're going to see in these visions. And really, you've seen these messages in the interpretations that Daniel has given to Nebuchadnezzar and to Belshazzar. And I mentioned in the first class, one of the themes of Daniel is that God rules in the kingdom of men. Right? Well, God is in control is just another way of saying that. But the message to Daniel's contemporaries, and probably any God-fearing person living in the intertestamental period, would have been one of encouragement. Persevere. Things are really bad right now, but they're not always going to be bad. And it's easier to make that leap, I guess, emotionally, if you are 100% comfortable with the fact that God is in control. So as we read Daniel 7, and as the trademarks of this kind of literature start to come out, definitely keep an eye out for them and get ready for these two themes, that God is in control and that we're to be strong and persevere. I'm going to read probably the first 8 verses or so of Daniel 7, if you'd like to follow along. So Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had the wings of an eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind also was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, Arise, devour, eat, devour much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet, and it was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were pulled up by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. So you've got all that, right?
Duh.
Right, moving on. So when does this vision occur relative to other events in Daniel's life that we've read about already?
King Nebuchadnezzar is no longer there, so now you've got a new king.
Right, which one is that?
Belshazzar.
Belshazzar.
So it would have been before the writing of the law, since directly after the writing of the law, Belshazzar's no longer.
Sure, yeah, I think that's kind of the conclusion I come to. When we read about the writing on the wall, that was right before King Belshazzar was killed. Even that night, the significance of that vision was delivered. And so what I conclude is that this was probably sometime before the writing on the wall vision and interpretation occurred. And you know, it almost seems like a kind of a private event to me. Daniel receives this vision on his own. This is kind of different than the other visions that Daniel has interpreted so far in the book, because in previous instances, he was called upon because of his reputation and his known ability and his known connection and relationship with God to give those interpretations. But in this case, the vision is coming directly to Daniel, so that makes it a little bit different. I think that's the first case like that that we've read about. Yeah, absolutely. That was actually going to be my next question, is what similarities do you see between this vision and the others?
Symbolism.
Symbolism. Yeah, like Alan said, there's absolutely symbols in this vision.
In the part of the statue, there were 4 parts of the statue here. There were 4 different beasts.
Okay, so if you think back to chapter 2, the vision of the statue, there were 4 components to that statue. The head of gold, representing Babylon, and then the three other medals. And we talked about how each of those represented a different kingdom. And conveniently in Daniel, what makes it nice to try to understand these visions in the book of Daniel is that a lot of the meanings have been just given to him, and so he passes those on to us in his writings. So there's two parallels we've talked about so far. We've definitely got symbols on both sides. We've got the same number of symbols, 4 and 4, if you compare this chapter to chapter 7. Okay, so that's a contrast would be the chapter 2 vision of the statue. Those are inanimate objects. Here we have animated objects. We've got animals. They're fictitious animals for the most part. What else?
They all need interpretation.
They all need interpretation? Yeah? Yeah, absolutely.
These are dreams. They're not like visions that happen while they're awake. So both Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar apparently are sleeping when this happens. So it either means something or it doesn't. Have to be told whether it means something.
Okay. Yeah, if you didn't hear Adam's point, these visions came while the person was asleep. That means that when they wake up, they've got to figure out what it means, if it means anything at all. Have you ever felt that way about a dream? I definitely have. I mean, I've had dreams that were so vivid, I woke up thinking, what on earth was that? You know, what part of my brain needed to delete that hard drive space? Dwayne? Okay.
I wouldn't contend for that. It just makes a little sense. That's all.
Yeah, I think we can definitely be sure that whatever the nature of this vision or dream was, it was impressed upon Daniel that it had a meaning. He didn't just discard it. He didn't just move on like a lot of the dreams you and I have. I mean, he believed that there was a meaning. And I think part of that is because his dream was different than any dream I'm ever going to have, and that's that he had some otherworldly beings in his presence able to talk to him about it. We'll get to that in a following passage. But to sum up this vision, we've got four beasts. We have a lion with eagle's wings in the heart of a man. We have a bear with ribs in its mouth. We have a four-headed leopard with four wings, and we have a horned beast. We're not really descriptive beyond that. It's just a beast. If you Google this vision, you're going to see lots of artistic renderings of what this fourth beast might have looked like. But the point is, it was horned, it had iron teeth, it had 10 horns, and then there's this little horn that comes up and starts speaking blasphemies. Let's continue reading in verse 9. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames, its wheels were a burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So in this passage, the focus of activity shifts from earth into heaven. And one like a son of man comes. And we see that these powerful beasts of earth, which if you just picture them purely in an earthly context, none of these beasts are animals that you and I would ever want to cross paths with. They have incredible power and ability, and they're equipped with wings and teeth and power that you and I don't possess. And so they're terrifying, and we might look at them fearfully, but when they are moved into the courts of heaven, they are judged. And their power is rendered irrelevant before the throne of the Most High. So how does that scene echo to you the themes that we've seen elsewhere in Daniel?
It shows the superiority and the supremacy of the power of God. That's the primary concept I've been getting from.
Yeah, the power of God over the power of earth, right? There's supremacy. There's a pecking order. And God's at the top of it every time, in all of these visions and with all of these kingdoms that we've studied. I take some comfort from that, but it's also very, very sobering in many ways for me. So consider this for a minute. We've studied thus far how Daniel's life and character are inspiring to us. We read what he said to Nebuchadnezzar. We read the words that he spoke to Belshazzar in front of 1,000 of his nobles. We read about how consistent and close his relationship was with God. We see that Daniel has a better prayer life. Well, I won't speak for all of you. He had a better prayer life than me. And we take inspiration and encouragement from that, but Daniel here in this vision glimpses something that maybe you and I run the risk of taking for granted at times. Daniel's getting a glimpse of the eternal kingdom that hasn't come yet. And so we are now living many, many centuries removed, I believe, from when God made that happen. But it hasn't happened for Daniel yet. So he's being given a glimpse of that. And it's difficult and amazing at the same time to try to imagine what that would have meant to him or what it could have meant to him and the people that lived after him. Let's continue on in verse 15. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Now, as we read this interpretation, try to check off in your mind the answers to the questions that you have right now. After reading this vision, I've got a lot of questions. Daniel is going to have the benefit of this attendant. And at the end, I think you're going to be like me. You're going to be left with a few items on your list that still haven't been checked off. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. But the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, for all ages to come. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. Exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which 3 of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One. And the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus he said, I believe referring to the one that Daniel is speaking to, thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. So is Daniel alone during this vision? What do you think?
Apparently he was alone, but in the vision there was somebody else besides him, or else he would have had the counsel of the explainer.
Okay, so, yeah, was he physically alone? Appears to be. But there was a presence, there was another intellect that was available to him during the vision, and he sought an interpretation. Most of the people I've talked to about this passage, most of the extra-biblical writings that I've referenced indicate that this was probably an angelic presence of some kind. It's not really clear, but there's a godly interpretation, I believe, that's being given to Daniel, one way or another. So the angelic interpretation, as we'll call it, goes like this. The beasts are four kings. So four men. We're talking about four men? No. Kingdoms, right? The first of many symbols in the interpretation. These beasts, when the angel says these are kings, really we're saying they're kingdoms. They're kingdoms, nations, they're ruling powers on the earth, but they're not necessarily the three individual men who reigned over those kingdoms. And that wouldn't work anyway, because even as we studied Daniel's time in the kingdom of Babylon, how many kings did we go through? Well, he stood before at least two of them. We know because of history there were probably a few that filled in between. So if the beasts are kingdoms, what do you think the ocean symbolizes, if it symbolizes anything at all?
It's not unusual in apocalyptic literature for the idea of a tumultuous ocean to bring to idea the thought of chaos and uncertainty.
Okay.
So I think that, I mean, for me personally, the four winds whipping the ocean into a frothy mess is the idea of the earth somewhat in turmoil.
Okay. And, you know, I'm just asking what you think. The angel doesn't tell Daniel that the ocean is significant. But the vision is full of symbols. Adam's point was maybe the ocean represents the turmoil that the earth is in, the four winds whipping up the ocean. Maybe the ocean represents humanity in general, and you've got these four beasts, these four most powerful empires coming out of the ocean of humanity. It's pure conjecture. Now notice verse 24. Is the word kings in this verse again used to represent kingdoms? Or are we talking about individuals at this point?
It says kingdom and kings, so you would mean it was 10 kings within a kingdom.
Right, yeah, I think we're now, it's clear, I think, from what the angel is telling him that these are literal kings. These are individuals, or at least they represent kings rather than kingdoms.
But to me, they all belong to the same kingdom.
Right. Whichever kingdom that fourth beast is. Now, to me, the beasts of Daniel 7 seem to parallel the kingdoms of chapter 2 in the statue vision. Couple of arguments in favor of that parallel. Both chapters seem to agree in the sequence of the kingdoms. And what I mean by that is, in chapter two, the vision about the statue, you had three kingdoms that just came and went, but then that fourth kingdom was different, right? It was different in its composition. There was special attention and significance given to that kingdom and how it differed from the other three, and then the eternal kingdom is what came and ultimately wiped it out. There's a similar pattern that you see in these four beasts in chapter 7. So I tend to think that the two lists are parallel to each other. These are the same four kingdoms, in other words. I'm interested in your thoughts on that, though.
Seems that there's more than coincidental parallels.
Mm-hmm.
The number 10.
Right.
And the final, there's 10 toes.
10 toes on 2 feet, 10 horns on the fourth beast, sure.
And the horns. So that would seem to be.
Well, another parallel I see is, you know, you remember that fourth kingdom in the statue was iron mixed with clay. The fourth beast has iron teeth. I don't know if that's significant, but it jumps out at me. You know, these are some of the details and the parallels that just jump out at me, Dwayne.
The stone cut from without hands also hit the fourth beast. Hit the feet of clay and iron.
Mm-hmm.
So that was
collapsible. Yeah, so the eternal kingdom, right, the eternal kingdom is what ends up coming after that fourth kingdom. It's also worth pointing out that chapter 7 ends the section of Daniel that's written in Aramaic, and we talked about in the first lesson how Daniel is different than a lot of other books because it's written in two different languages. Well, the end of chapter 7 is where the Aramaic portion of Daniel ends. It also parallels chapter 2 in that chiastic structure that we talked about. So 2 and 7 have the same kind of vision, the same pattern in each vision. To me, it's a parallel not just in its meaning and its content, but also in its location in chapters 2 through 7. Yeah. Jimmy?
I'm waiting for you to get through
it all. I'm taking too long. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. If you didn't hear Jimmy's comments, he's just pointing out that verses 13 and 14, you know, are clearly talking about the kingdom of Jesus Christ and his coming. I may not have said that clearly enough a minute ago when I was referencing chapter 2, but that's absolutely the most important parallel that I see in these two visions, is that the kingdom of God comes in the form of Jesus Christ and puts an end to, well, it becomes the most eternal ruling kingdom, the most powerful kingdom, even more so than any of these earthly kingdoms. And, you know, that's also what I was referring to when I said Daniel gets a glimpse of something that you and I have been encouraged by probably most of our lives. So, what do these four kingdoms have in common? We're talking about Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Just from an earthly perspective, what are some things that you see that all four of these kingdoms have in common? I mean, to me, they're all world powers at the time. And I don't know that any kingdom in the world today rules like those kingdoms did. I think it's fair to say that no kingdom since Rome has really ruled the way that Rome did.
So they were, well, I don't know if I should say, they're better ruled by patience than situations today. I'm not trying to say that war today is civilized, but what we read about them, they were
Okay.
Each one kind of set a record. Like when Babylon comes on the scene, it's the first time any kingdom has really been that widespread.
Sure.
And then Medo-Persia exceeds it, and then Greece exceeds it, and then Rome kind of becomes this ultimate ruling.
So it keeps pushing the envelope with each kingdom. I did some research on this. It's estimated that the world population in the first century might have been 150 million on the low end, 500 million, half a billion on the absolute extreme end, but most of the demographic researchers put it around 300 million. 300 million people in the entire world in the first century. We have more people than that in the USA today. I think part of the thing that's interesting to me about this is just the logistical nature of it. You can have 300 million people under a government. You can have 300 million people spread across Europe, Northern Africa, what is today Western Russia, spread out over that huge area, and you can still have them under one rule. But there are 7 to 8 billion people in the world today. I've often wondered if part of God's plan for getting rid of some of these world empires is just the natural fact that we keep repopulating the earth. He allows all of those things to happen. But it's hard to imagine an empire like Rome that is physically capable of ruling this earth today with 8 million people in play on 6 or 7 continents. Has one nation ever been dominant in the ways that Rome has been since Rome fell? Did I say Roman has been? Rome has been. I don't think so. Sure. But do you think this prophecy has withstood the test of time? I would say the answer is yes. I think without a doubt, these two visions that show these four kingdoms working their way up and then being ended and nothing else like them ever coming again has absolutely played out and is absolutely supported by world history. Okay, so further interpretation. I want to spend the rest of the class just talking about this and maybe gearing up for next week, because next week I want us to look at Revelation. We've looked at some parallels between Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 7. Next week I want to look at some parallels with Revelation. So at this point in the study, are you fully satisfied with your understanding of this vision? Jimmy is. Jimmy's good. Yes. The fourth beast being the kingdom of just generally the forces of evil.
It's talking about the kingdom of Satan, the devil, the most high,
Yeah, they're referring to the little horn that's speaking blasphemies. Yeah, so that's one of the questions. Donna's asking one of the questions that I'm left with. I'm curious, who are these 10 kings? Who is the little horn? Which 3 kings did the little horn uproot? I'm not going to tell you this morning that I have 100% figured those things out, but I don't know that we have to. Those are just the questions that pop into my head after I read this vision. Dwayne.
We could look at a map of the United States and it makes sense. We understand the arrangement. States. There's a great amount of detail that's not revealed just by that information.
Sure, and there's also, I think, some detail in these visions that may not jump out at us, but might have been a little more clear and apparent to people living in Daniel's time and in the centuries that follow. And I want to give you a couple of those views so that you can think about them as we prepare for the next class. Yeah.
Part of the genre
Right.
Attacks of 10 people.
Yeah, absolutely.
10 codes don't attack to 10 people.
Right.
Sometimes it's just a graphic way that they're writing it.
Sure.
They want to paint a picture online.
Yeah, and we've got to be careful with numbers, especially. Sometimes when I read Revelation, I think Revelation should have been called Numbers. But we have to be careful with what we do with those numbers. That's a great point. I appreciate that. There's a modernist view on this vision that likens the little horn to Antiochus Epiphanes. He lived and persecuted Jews in the 2nd century BC. So that would have been 300 to 400 years removed from Daniel's life, but we're still a couple of hundred years before the fall of the Roman Empire, and that fact is kind of the biggest challenge that I see for that view. It was first proposed by Porphyry. You may or may not remember his name, but I mentioned Porphyry in the very first class because he wrote a multi-volume piece called Against the Christians, in which he critiqued the entire faith and much of Judaism along with it. And do you remember what his main objection was to the book of Daniel? Daniel can't be prophecy because it's too accurate. There's no way that that's prophecy, that's history. So if you take the stance from day one that Daniel is history and that it was written sometime after Daniel's life, you've got to find a historical character to represent that little horn, assuming you're certain that that's what that is. And so in this view, Antiochus Epiphanes becomes that person. But again, the problem is that, well, there's really two problems. He lived 2 centuries before the fall of the Roman Empire. And this would also require the fourth kingdom to be Greece instead of Rome, probably, because that was the empire of Antiochus Epiphanes, in which he lived. And so instead of the second beast being the Medes and the Persians, what you have to do is split it up and say the first beast is Babylon, the second beast is the Medes, the third beast is the Persians, and the fourth beast is Greece. But all of the description that we're given about that fourth beast fits Rome way better than it fits Greece. I hope that makes some sense. There's a couple of big challenges to that view. There's also a premillennial view that there's multiple premillennial views, but one in particular takes the position that the horn, the little horn, is the Antichrist, which has yet to reveal himself. And you have to dig deep into Revelation to really put some flesh on that. But there are a couple of problems with this view, too. And one of them is that, as we'll see next week, there's a parallel between Daniel and Revelation, but it really has nothing to do with the Antichrist from what I can see. Trying to find common ground in both books over the topic of the Antichrist is kind of difficult. But the little horn that arose during the Fourth Kingdom seems to happen towards the end. And so if we're still waiting on the Antichrist, and that's who this little horn represents, then, as was pointed out a second ago, what significance does this vision really have to Daniel or anybody living in his time? Almost none. I think that's a major challenge against that view. There's another view that the little horn represents the papal dynasty. So the succession of popes that have come out of the Roman Catholic Church and the nation of Rome. This is a really interesting view in some ways to me because it was the main view held by, I believe, many of the key figures in the Reformation. And there are even some key figures in the Restoration Movement that began in this country that held to this view pretty tightly. It has a lot of little details going for it, and it's the kind of thing that I have a hard time taking a firm stand for or against because I'm not enough of a scholar. But it is what it is. I found it interesting and wanted to propose it because I believe without a doubt that the fourth beast is Rome. And so if the fourth beast is Rome and the power of Rome is ended, and the trouble that Daniel would have been told about through his revelation has come to pass, is it possible that a part of that beast continues on? Maybe. I don't know. I leave it for your consideration. But there's also a purely symbolic view. Since everything else about this vision is symbolic, the numbers must be as well. Or the numbers likely are symbolic as well. To really explain that, not literally 10 kings, as was pointed out a second ago. Maybe 10 is a round number. 10 is a whole, complete number. It's used that way a lot in Scripture. it still differentiates this beast and the kingdom that it represents from all the others, because there are lots of kings in this fourth kingdom. Were there exactly 10? There were more than that in Rome. So what does 10 represent? Could be purely symbolic. The total sum of Roman rule, if you will. If you carry this out, the three kings that were uprooted, maybe not necessarily three kings, but a significant portion of the rule of Rome is uprooted or is affected by this little horn. Is this one little horn speaking blasphemies and warring against God's people a single individual? Or is it maybe some minority of Roman rule that was especially effective at persecuting God's people? I'm asking a lot of questions and not offering any answers, and I know that's annoying, but that's the nature of Daniel 7, yeah.
Just a few, like,
yeah, please.
Background things with some of this. Again, I don't think it has to be highly specific. It's kind of like pictures of Revelation of destruction. They're just typical pictures of what destruction looks like. When a nation surrounds and lays siege to a city, that's what it looks like. And so he's using images they recognize. And I think with this, and when you think about Roman history from our perspective, how does it all come about? You got these triumphants, and you're throwing down rulers, and people are being killed, and people are taking power. And the whole concept of 10, you don't have 10 kings without being a substantial kingdom and being a strong,
right,
and powerful
kingdom. Right.
So I think that comes into play as well. It's not necessarily about the specifics as much as it is. These people are reading all of this, and they realize in the future there are going to be these powers, these strong powers, and that's what it looks like to be a strong power. These sorts of things.
Yeah. I appreciate the way you articulated that, and I think a good follow-up there is to remember we are trying to look back and make sense of these 10 horns. But Daniel is looking forward, and anybody who had read this is looking forward and knowing that this is a kingdom that's going to come in the future. And so the descriptions about this kingdom, I think, are intended for a person who is trying to imagine what a kingdom like that would be like. And there's a pitfall for us, since this kingdom has already come and gone, and we can look back at the history books, and we're trying to figure out, okay, which 10 emperors of Rome is this? That's not really the way it was intended. I appreciate that. A few things for y'all to consider for next week. Please read Revelation 13. And compare the beast of Revelation 13 with the fourth beast of Daniel 7. And just note any parallels that you see. And then go back and read Revelation 12. And ask yourself, is there anything in Revelation 12 that helps me understand Revelation 13, or did it just make things worse and I wish Kurt would quit asking me to read this stuff? And I'm not saying that there is a parallel here, but this is part of the growing process, at least it has been for me, to get into this kind of writing. The conclusions that I draw from all of this is still the same messages that are there in the apocalyptic writings that we've read so far, and that's that God is in control. The kingdoms and rulers of the earth have acted arrogantly in their power and their position, and they've been judged in the courts of heaven, and God rules in heaven and on earth. Does that give you some comfort as a 21st century Christian? Does it give you some comfort living in a nation that sometimes has its own parallels with Rome before it fell? Does it give you comfort to know that even though oftentimes the rulers of this nation seem like ungodly, unfaithful people, that God is still in control? Gives me comfort. Yeah, Dwayne and Donna.
Yeah, I think